Hey everyone, this podcast is with Daniel Massicott. Daniel is a Rockstar VIP member who I've talked to at various VIP events where we do dinners and go to banquet halls and special presentations and that type of stuff. And me and Daniel have struck up a conversation a few times, and I always thought he was a funny and interesting guy. And he's done quite well in business for himself, creating multiple businesses and income streams in his life. So I just wanted to sit down with him and unpack what those are and how we created those, and just really speak to him about how he's created these different streams of income and that have allowed him to leave his 9-to-5 job and created freedom in his life and his life on his terms. And his Rockstar Inner Circle coach, Nadeem Ahmed, joined us as well. And him and Nadeem have done a student rental property together, and they're working on some other stuff in real estate together right now. And so I just wanted to have Nadeem on as well, because Nadeem has built a close relationship working with him as his Rockstar coach. So for those who don't know, when you join up for the Rockstar Inner Circle, you get set up with a one-on-one personal real estate investing coach. And these are guys that are experienced in real estate investing themselves. They're established investors who have built up their own portfolio and then decided to get their real estate license and are now helping other Rockstar investors do the same thing. So sitting them down for a one-on-one meeting when you first sign up as a member, then going through your short-term objectives, your long-term goals. What do you want to accomplish from your real estate investing? And then reverse engineering from that end goal, different real estate strategies, and with wherever you're at in life right now, whatever your situation is, how to create those next steps to be able to build towards that final goal. And so that's what your Rockstar coach is there to do. They help you establish those goals and then go out there and actually help build that portfolio with you and deal with all the different problems and issues and obstacles that you can easily overcome, but you have to overcome them, but that come up on your inevitable journey in real estate investing. So that's what they're there to do, and kind of hold your hand through that process and be your support system and person to lean on. So thank you for Nadeem for joining us as well. And if you're interested in learning more about the Rockstar Inner Circle or working with the Rockstar Real Estate Investing Coach, just reach out. Phone us, email us, text us, however you can, contact us. There's multiple different ways to reach out. I'm sure you can find out how to do so. RockstarInnerCircle.com has a contact us page there. And with that, let's get on with the show.
Are you ready to live life on your terms? Is it time to take charge? Real estate, business building, the economy, health and nutrition, and more. It's the Your Life, Your Term Show with Tom and Nick Carrazza. Are you ready? Let's go.
And Nadeem's like, dude, you got to get this guy in the podcast. Like, he's got a dating app, he's doing insurance, he's doing real estate. There's a Lego business or something involved here. So we just wanted to have you on because clearly you're up to some big stuff here and making it work somehow. So just wanted to get to know you better, man.
Cool. Okay.
And all at a very young age.
How old are you?
I mean, how old am I or how old do I look?
I don't want to guess. Yeah. I don't want to insult you, but you look young.
Go as young as you can.
32?
That's great. Oh, that's what I get from most people.
32? Younger?
Older.
Yeah. Older?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
So you can...
36?
You can go older. Sky's the limit now.
40? I don't think you're 40.
No, I'm not 40.
Okay, I'd be shocked at that.
I'm not 40, but you know, somewhere between 36 and 40.
For okay, sure. Well, a young buck.
A young buck, yeah.
So what's the story? Like, what do you do? What? Name one thing, and we'll start with that.
Usually when I talk to people, I tell them I do three things. I do Lego, dating, and insurance. Mm-hmm. Or actually, I do Lego, insurance, and dating. And people immediately just talk about Lego. And they're like, oh, you do Lego? What do you do? And then we talk about Lego.
For me, the dating is the most interesting one. I'm like, what do you mean you do dating?
So I didn't start off deciding to get into dating. What I did was I was working for a marketing agency up in Richmond Hill. And sometime after I started working for them, but before they went bankrupt, I started looking for all of their clients. They gave me a book of business to work, but I only approached the clients who were actually in Toronto, because then I could go out for lunch and, you know, they would pay for dinner, lunch. And so, you know, I'd get a free lunch and then I could, you know, get to know people face to face. And so I did this a lot. And most of the people I met were kind of like those sort of recluse programmer type mentality, sort of people who don't like talking to people, right? They don't like eye contact. But there was one guy I met who we chatted a little bit, we did a little bit of stuff on the side, and then he introduced me to his partner, who then eventually ended up becoming my partner.
Okay.
And so we did a bit of business while I was working at this company, eventually we got to a point where we couldn't grow the company further than, like, we kind of, I don't know, made the same amount of profit for the last like 3 months, 6 months. And we thought, okay, it's time for Daniel to quit. And then we were three partners and then we were four, and that's that.
And so you quit to start the dating app?
I would say I didn't quit to start a dating app. I actually made my employer my best customer, actually. I was kind of friends with the CFO. We just hit it off there. And I just said to him, look, there's a need to solve this particular problem, right? It was basically exit traffic that was going through some shitty rotator. And so I said, you know, we're building a better one. And this was in 2017 when not every affiliate marketing company was doing rotators.
What's a rotator?
It's basically you take a whole bunch of offers that are kind of the same. Sorry, offers, right? What's an offer? let's go back a bit. An offer is basically like the landing page for Your Life, Your Terms. That's an offer. Somebody signs up, $2 is paid out to the promoter of that site. That's an offer, lead gen. So we would take like 50 or 100 dating sites that all look the same, and we would load them into this rotator, and that's load them into this sort of chain or something. And then when somebody would go to the site or click that link, it would just rotate through the offer they would see, because every dating site is the same anyway.
So how do we get to the dating app then?
Well, everybody keeps saying a dating app, but there was never an app in the picture. Like, it was just a whole bunch of websites that we launched.
Okay, so you're doing marketing for dating apps.
Precisely, yeah. It's basically affiliate marketing. It's just that we end up creating a whole bunch of our own sites in the process. And the company I worked for, they're called Mundo Media. They were like our best customer for a long time. We used to do a ton of money with them. But then they went under, and by that time I had left, and we had a whole bunch of other networks that were working with us. So it was...
So the dating sites you created, these are like niche dating sites?
Yeah, niche dating sites. We kind of made it fun, because usually you have to appeal to the guy who's promoting the dating site more so than the guy who's signing up to the dating site. Like a banner on the side panel on Reddit where guys are talking about not being able to get laid is going to be a lot better and get a lot more exposure and signups than some super duper targeted banner on, I don't know, wherever, right? A site that doesn't get as much, the more niche, right? So we use the niches and kind of like the cute front page website appeal to the guy who's setting up the banner as opposed to the guy who's signing up. Because at the end of the day, the guy who's setting up the banner, he's going to put whatever banner he wants. He could put get naked girls in your bedroom tomorrow morning, no questions asked.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have any control over that, right? So, yeah.
Okay, so your clients were the dating site providers, like the people actually running the dating sites that you were doing the marketing for them.
Our clients were affiliate marketers.
Got it. I don't fully get it.
Let's just focus on the fun stuff. You know? Guys signing up dating sites. Right?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, yeah, wow. Okay, so then, okay, well then, what about the Lego business?
So I started in Lego, let's see, I started collecting Lego when everybody starts collecting Lego, right? Like when they're 6 or 7 years old. But when I was 16, I found out that I could buy Lego parts at the flea market and sell them online individually. And there was a market for that. So people would be like, a guy would want to make like a house like that, and he would need a whole bunch of roof plates or roof slopes. And to go out and buy the roof slopes from the set that has the most of them, he'll end up a whole bunch of parts that he doesn't need. So he would go to a third-party marketplace, and he would go buy all of those parts, and he would probably pay a little bit more for them than, you know, maybe you buy the set for $100, but the total amount of parts is worth, if they all sold, is worth maybe $500 or $600. So somebody who can acquire these sets at a discount and has the room to hold all these parts, they can sell them online for basically a killing, as long as they manage their business, you know, appropriately and, you know.
Because Lego doesn't sell individual pieces, they sell just all sets?
For a long time, they didn't. Now they do. I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called Bricks and Pieces. But there's all kinds of other issues to take into account. Like, this is now, then. This is like when I was 16. This is like, you know, do the math. It was like 20-odd years ago. But like now the way it is the... you can buy from Lego direct, but you might wind up waiting like 2 months there's like supply chain issues and other stuff to take into account. So sometimes the independent seller can just kind of like, oh yeah, sure. Like this weekend, I got an order from this guy. He's located down in Grimsby. He's building a whole ton of custom sets. He's always waiting for parts, and he needs it now. So he needs somebody who's selling in Canada. He doesn't care that the exchange rate from USD to Canadian is 1.37 or 1.3. He doesn't care. He needs it for his custom thing for his own business, and he needs it like in 4 days. And so he can come to me and get it right away as opposed to, you know, wait for 2 months.
Like, so do you have like a physical warehouse or your house is dedicated to holding all these different parts and then you're reselling them?
Yeah. So over the years, the business has kind of evolved a little bit, right? When I was in like high school and early university, I was selling used parts. But then I did like that 80-20 rule thing and I was like, okay, wait a minute, you know, like 90% of my time is involved pulling parts out from the various bins, and most of my profit comes from just selling minifigures. So from there, I thought, okay, why don't I just sell minifigures? And I just took all the parts and I just dumped them in my own Lego inventory and I just started selling minifigures. And like, you can take a bucket, you know, you could have a bin right here that's, you know, the size of two large watermelons. You know, a little allusion back to the dating. two large watermelons, and you could have like $60,000 worth of inventory in there.
Okay.
Right? So you can kind of, you can have like a lot of inventory in a small space in a condo in Toronto, right? And then you just get an order, and it's almost 100% variable cost. You don't have to worry about rent because you're renting anyway, right? You don't have to worry about any of those fixed things, maybe a little bit of marketing if you want. But more often than not, it's better not to force the system because people are going to want to build things anyway. And they're going to want to buy because it gets rare and, you know, Lego retires sets. So then they go up in value.
Is it still as popular as it used to be when we were younger?
Yeah, more so actually now. So most of what I do is Star Wars Lego figures, new Star Wars Lego figures. So it's very niche. And basically, you'll have a guy who's like in his 40s or 50s. Who has a bit of extra money to spend, and he'll just be like, okay, you know what? I'm building the Death Star, right? Or whatever, right? I'm building the room where, you know, General Moff Tarkin is, you know, getting choked. And so he's going to put so much detail and time into building that room that by the end of that MOC, my own creation, mock, by the end of building that thing and putting so much time and money, maybe $3,000 or $4,000 in parts, he doesn't care that he has to spend an extra $250 on the minifigures because they add all the prettiness to the whole room. So that's kind of where the demand kind of comes into it.
So it's kind of like a niche within the...
A niche within a niche, yeah.
So this is something you did as a kid and just slowly built up over time.
Like, yeah, like some people sell watches and they just save all the watches in a safe in their basement. And some people, you know, I don't know, they... buy real estate and, you know, build up a collection.
Collect cards.
Yeah, fair enough.
Baseball cards.
I guess when you put it that way, yeah.
But
no different.
But see, like, I've never met a guy who collected baseball cards who actually had them all for sale at any given time where somebody could just kind of go in and be like, okay, you know what? Those 100 figures like this that you have, can I give you $5 for them and just buy them all right now? Like, okay, I'm selling them for $7. He wants $5. My ROI is still going to be 40-50% or my margin, whatever. Yeah, sure. What the hell? Let's do it. Right? Most baseball card collectors have them all in a drawer like that, locked away, and nobody knows they're there. So that's the difference.
Is this like a main hustle for you or a side hustle?
This is what you would call a side hustle, but it makes more than most people make in their side hustles, I guess.
Okay, so it's a very profitable side hustle.
Yeah.
Okay, now insurance.
Yeah.
You also have an insurance business.
Insurance agency, yeah.
Insurance agency.
Yeah.
Okay, can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so an insurance agency is basically, we just sell insurance. But as opposed to the typical thing where you usually have like an insurance agent who kind of works all by themselves, you kind of want to have a little bit of experience, so to speak, you know, like talent on the roster. So I have an assistant. She's been in the space for about 20 years, actually 30 now. Long time. And she used to support the top guys at some of the other top agencies in Toronto. So we sell life DICI, life insurance, critical illness and disability. And honestly, for the most part, I've just been selling to people I know because a few years ago, I felt kind of starved for meeting people. And, you know, when you work from home and the dating thing, you're kind of like a recluse.
Basically. So the dating thing was like your main hustle?
It was my main hustle. Yeah.
Okay. Which you transitioned out of your 9 to 5 or your marketing job before that?
Yeah. I mean, what did I do? I came to Toronto. I worked at RBC for a bit. Then I went transitioned to dating. No, after that, I did the date. Then I did lead gen, racked up a ton of debt, you know, really like terrible. And then I went to get a job in sales at the agency, paid off all my debt, paid off all my loans and everything. And that's where then the dating thing kind of came after that. So,
okay. And then the insurance, that's another side hustle. That's a main hustle.
No, insurance is becoming a main hustle now, certainly for sure. I started insurance when I came to Toronto like 12 years ago. But because the dating thing, I just busy.
So when you were buying real estate, did you not also have an accounting company?
Yeah, for a time.
Yeah.
I didn't do so good.
Accounting too.
You know, so the way it goes is like, you know, I don't know if I would call myself an entrepreneur, but something like that, right? It's like, you try many things. And usually the hobbies that you try or the business that you try are closely in line with what you like. I always liked accounting. I studied accounting when I was in university, flunked my way through university, barely made it out, got kicked out 3 times. Right. So by the time I graduated.
What did you get kicked out for?
Low grades.
Okay.
Yeah. No drunken debauchery for me.
I was hoping for some stories.
Yeah. No, I never really got drunk. Actually, the whole time I was there, I was like a good student, just not good on paper.
Yeah. Well, you might as well have drank if you're going to. You're going to take that route.
I know. Some of my grades are really low, actually. People didn't even believe the grades. Like, what'd you get? It's like 37%. Can you believe it? And they'd be like, you always sit in the front row. You're such a clown.
Okay.
So going back to the accounting. So
yeah.
That was you had a firm, accounting firm?
Yeah. That didn't turn out so great, actually. I really learned a few valuable lessons there. Among them, don't have partners. Actually, it's not true. Actually, I've had great partners in my life, but don't have partners that don't add value and bring value to the table in a very concrete way. I guess that's the way I'd put it.
Mm.
Yeah. So I made a lot of money, but also lost a lot of money. It happens.
Yeah. So you had a passion for accounting. You got into that.
Yeah.
You had a passion for Lego. Obviously, you got into that. Insurance?
Yeah.
Did you have a passion for that? Or how did you get into insurance?
So my uncle on my dad's side is like the first sort of wealthiest uncle in the family, and he got into it through insurance. I found out about insurance when I came back to Canada. I was teaching English in Korea for a few years. That was in 2011 or 12. And I was like, okay, this is a concept I understand very well. You know, dump money into a vehicle, have it grow tax-free, borrow against it later. You know, how can you lose, right? So I was like, okay, this is great. I'm sold. But when I came to Toronto, the landscape was very different than it is now. You know, like 10, 12 years ago, everybody worked for a financial company. Everybody had tons of coverage and benefits, and it was mostly Canadians. Now it's like a much larger international mix. A lot of people who were wealthy in their home countries have kind of sold off everything, and now they're here, and now they're like, hey, you know, I want to put the insurance I need in place for my family. They know what they want. They just need it in Canada because they've kind of cut off ties with back home.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's fun. But what's most fun with insurance is selling to people I like. It's like, I meet you. I like you. I want to keep you in my life because your agent is like, your insurance broker is kind of like someone in your life for a long time. It has to be somebody who's like married to Canada, who's not going to leave, who's not going to get a passport and go to another country, right? It has to be somebody who's going to be here because the exit is you just sell your book of business to another agent or to a bigger company. It's kind of like a slap in the face, right?
Mm.
So your agent has to be somebody who's stable in here forever and who's going to be like there by your side throughout the various stages. And I like that, right? So
for a guy that was flunking university, you were teaching in Korea?
Yeah, I was teaching English, right? I wasn't flunking in English. Actually, in university, I started in business. I started in accounting, actually. And then I switched. So I got kicked out 3 times. And then the third time I got kicked out, they sent me a letter. And it was McGill, right? And they just sent a letter. And it just said, we strongly recommend, no, after repeated attempts to get back into the faculty, we strongly recommend that you don't reapply, but find some other thing to do. So I switched to the Faculty of Arts. And did a major in English literature. Mm-hmm. And that was mostly just essays and reading books. And that wasn't so bad. There was no sort of pressure issue on the exams. So that I passed and I did just fine. So
how was the experience in Korea?
Korea was good. Koreans, they work hard. They are the only community, one of the few communities in Toronto that comes here and trusts their own. So it's like a good thing, right? Some people come here and they don't trust their own. And so you kind of get this feeling like, huh, what's going on? But after being in Korea for 2 years, I have a Korean dentist, Korean lawyer, Korean accountant, Korean mortgage broker, Korean real estate agent, Korean friends, family maybe.
Do you speak Korean now?
Yeah, I speak a little bit of Korean. I can speak elementary Korean. I can get by.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. So why'd you come back to Canada?
Because so Korea is nice, but there's not a lot of innovation. And also like
compared to Canada?
Yeah, no, it's not that. Like now you're comparing it now to versus Canada 10 years ago, right? But it's like
it's very different Canada.
I know, it's very different Canada. It's the thing is like when you're in another country and you don't speak the vernacular language, you don't really connect on a deep level. And that's how it is for all these people coming here. And that's why, you know, here, we'll bring it back to insurance for a quick dip, right? It's like when you're telling somebody, hey, you know, how much critical illness you're going to need, right? It's like this insurance policy that pays out when you get a life-threatening condition, like cancer, right? So you get cancer, you survive 30 days, you get a payout. When you're looking at how much money someone's going to need, yeah, sure, you know, you can look at how what your expenses are for the next 12 to 24 months. But what a lot of things happen, especially in the Korean community, and I've seen in other ones, is people go back home. The treatment they get back home is superior to the treatment they get here. We had a friend who she was diagnosed with some late stage of cancer, and the treatment here was, yeah, you're not going to make it. And so they remortgaged their home, they flew back to Korea, and I think she's still there. And she got an extra 4 or 5 years. She's still kind of on death's row now, but 4 or 5 years is better than 6 months, right? So this sort of, you know, in the case of insurance, you can always put that kind of money in place to fund that trip back to Korea, right? Because it happens, and that's going to be like 100K, right? So there's this sort of thing where you have all these people coming here, but their true medical treatment, sort of not way, but what their body responds to, is probably not what they're getting here. And a lot of people aren't particularly happy with sort of the way they get treated here.
What's your case for critical illness and disability insurance? Like, why would you recommend somebody get it?
So for disability, you're protecting the income. So you're walking across the street, two cars, I don't know, jam your two legs together, you can't walk anymore. Does that affect your job? Does that affect your ability to do your job? Yes or no, right? If you can't go to the office anymore, does it produce a reduction in your hours, that kind of thing? If it affects your job and affects your income, then it needs to be protected in order to continue paying for your family, your expenses. That's pretty straightforward. Disability insurance is like maybe, I don't know, $65 to $85 a month. So it's not really like a large amount. My dad had bought a lot of it. He was a doctor. And he ended up using it later in life. I think without it, it would have been harder. A lot harder.
Wow. What percentage of your income does it typically cover?
66.7%.
Is the maximum?
Yeah, because you're paying for the premiums with your after-tax money, and so it's kind of assumed that you're covering, paying with premiums after-tax dollars, so you're getting money that's not going to be taxed. So it's like a roundabout number.
Oh, I guess all that income is tax-free?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's something you just report on your tax return or something if you're actually collecting that?
I don't know, actually. You know, I worked at RBC in claims for a year, and I don't remember seeing too many tax slips coming out for people, but that was group insurance, so I'm not sure. I didn't work on the personal.
Yeah.
But generally, if it's being paid to you with after-tax dollars, then, you know, sort of like an insurance benefit the insurance companies have is like, then, okay, so the money you get paid, then it's not taxed. But then on the flip side, if you own a corporation, right, and you're deducting the premiums, then there's going to be a taxable, you know, income. It's going to be like rolled back into revenue. So sometimes like a smaller business might be like, hey, you know, we have like 2 or 3 employees, and so we want to have a bit of security to kind of keep these employees here. So we'll get a disability policy, but we'll pay for it. And actually, the smarter thing maybe to do there is to change it around a little bit so that it comes up on their pay, but then refund them and, you know. Accountant conversation, you know, the accounting business is not really my thing anymore, so I'm not allowed to talk about accounting.
True. Yeah, I have critical illness and a disability policy, and I was like looking over it on the weekend because I'm just looking at my expenses. What can I cut? I'm like, you know, I was sold on it at the time, and I just needed to kind of refresh my memory of why I signed up for this and the importance of it. And I was like, all right, like, it's not that much. You're right. I think it's for disability. I pay like 50, 56 bucks or something.
Yep.
Covers some income coming in. So would you just kind of recommend it for people that just don't have those plans as part of their workplace coverage? Entrepreneurs, or if you work in a small business, you don't have that coverage already. Do you recommend disability? And
I think like everybody should have a little bit of something, just something, because it gives you options, right? With CI, you can always reduce the coverage. You know, if you bought $400,000, you could just call the insurance company or call your broker and just be like, hey, you know, what would it cost? You know, not doing anything, right? Is what would it cost if we reduce the face from $150,000 to $75,000? What's it going to cost me? And they'll tell you. For life insurance, sometimes what you can do is, if you've been paying into a life insurance policy for a long time, you can say, hey, I want this to last me for the rest of my life, but I don't want to pay for it anymore. So if it was like a $2 million policy, maybe it's only going to be for $500,000, but you don't have to pay for any more and it covers you for life. So there's different things you can do. Apparently, like every insurance company had, they have sort of like this rule book. It's like a giant big ass, you know, like the lawyer books that they have that's like 3 inches thick or something, with all the things you can and can't do with their policies. And this is not shared with us agents. We just, you know, us peons just get the policy and that's it. So, but you don't know if you don't ask. Right.
Mm-hmm. The CI one, it's hard for me to kind of analyze if it's really good coverage or not, because it, I think the one I have, like, it lists like 25 different illnesses that are critical that could happen that you're covered for. But I'm like, how common are these illnesses versus other common critical illnesses out there? And like, am I really covered for what's most likely to happen to me if something were to befall me? Like, it's, I just don't know enough to know if it's worth it, but I have it just in case, until at least maybe at a certain point in my life where I can self-insure against that type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. What I've really loved about critical illness, my favorite policy, is the one where you get your money back after a certain amount of years, because then it's like an automatic savings mechanism. It's like a pre-con, right? You can buy a pre-con and you're betting that the market's going to go up, but you're also betting that you're not going to spend the money right now, right? So it's kind of like, yeah, I might sell it later, and yeah, it might cost me some fees, but I probably would have blown that money on hookers and cocaine. So
obviously, I'm not going to be,
you know, I'm going to have that access to it later on, right? And it's going to be hard to get it out, because it's so hard to sell a bloody assignment these days, that, you know, it's like you're going to really want it to get it out of there, right? Mm-hmm. So with this favorite product of mine, it's critical illness. The way it works is called return of premium. So you just, you buy it, and then you have to pay into it for a certain number of years. And then, so if you get a claim before then, great, you covered the risk. And then after that certain number of years, you can just ask for your money back.
Hmm.
This I like.
What's that type of policy called? Is there a word for that?
It's like whatever.
I'd like my money back.
Like whatever policy you have.
Yeah.
Is it like for life or is it term?
Term 20 for the critical. The disability, I think, is for life or until 65. I have to review it.
Yeah. So what you'd have to do is, just, so term 20, how long have you been paying it?
Oh man, like 2 years.
Okay. Okay, that's great. That's great. Great. So it's like, it's kind of got some longevity left. So anytime after you've been paying for it and before it expires, you can always just contact the insurance company and be like, hey, what can I do with this?
Got it.
This is my situation. I heard I could do this. What can I do? And then they'll just tell you.
Yeah.
But make sure you transfer that policy over to me to manage it first.
Yeah. Or yeah, there's been a few insurance guys on this podcast that might be vying for that business. But
yeah.
Wow. Okay. So the Lego stuff is the side hustle, the insurance, the dating,
main hustle,
the accounting. Yeah. It's just interesting how you kind of keep these balls up in the air to prevent yourself from having to go back to a job. Like you just keep picking up these hustles. Has it created freedom in your life, do you think?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I haven't worked a full-time job, like a 9-to-5. I mean, I work more than full-time, but I haven't worked a 9-to-5 job where someone's like, yeah, you gotta sit at this desk. Since 2016. But even that, when I was working at the agency, I mean, it was kind of like sales. So you can kind of do whatever you want as long as your numbers are there. But yeah.
What do you enjoy about your life now that you have these
flexibility,
income streams,
options?
Yeah.
Yeah. Flexibility, options.
We haven't talked about real estate either.
Yes, and you're a Rockstar VIP member. So
yeah.
How did you end up finding Rockstar?
Oh yeah, that question. Yeah, let's ask that question. It's a good one. I liked Dan Kennedy and his stuff. I used to listen to all his tapes. I read all his books, all his stuff. He's like sort of a direct marketer, right?
How'd you discover Dan Kennedy?
I discovered Dan Kennedy through another guy by the name of Yannick Silver, who's like this other guy down in California who sells ebooks. So I found these guys, like whenever you look up to someone, the question is, who's their mentor, right? And you can just skip the bullshit and go straight to the source. And sometimes that leads you all the way up to Think and Grow Rich. Mm-hmm. But in my case, even in that case, I remember reading Think and Grow Rich and thinking, okay, this is all concept. Who's the real guy? And the real guy was this guy by the name of Clement Stone. And he owned an insurance company. Maybe that's what got me into insurance, right? This was years ago. I read about him. He had this book called The Success System That Never Fails. Fantastic book. It's like 80 pages or something. It's very good. And there's an audiobook too, so you can listen to it while driving. No excuses, right? But like that was always my thing. And that's always been my thing is if I look up to you, I'm looking for your mentor. And because your mentor is always going to be obviously more ahead than you are, right? And so that's the thing. So I was looking at this guy and I was thinking, who's his mentor? And his mentor was Dan Kennedy. And so the farthest up I went there was this guy. And then I thought sometime in 20, I think it was like 17, I was thinking, okay, wait a minute. I'm about to close my first condo. Who are Dan Kennedy's students? Because then I'll get something local. I mean, Dan Kennedy's in the US, right? I mean, he's not around anymore, right? But like he was in the US and he was always talking about US stuff. And I was like, who's here in Canada? Who's in Toronto who's studying his stuff? There are conferences. I've seen people, I've met people, and I've seen them on the promotional videos on YouTube. So I've seen people there. So I found Rockstar Real Estate. I don't know how, Google, I guess. Somehow there was something that was dropped, some kind of direct response, money magnet, something, right? And that's so I joined back then. But back then I had a condo. I didn't have a lot of cash flow. I didn't really know what I was doing. I had a coach here, but I didn't really have the resources to make anything work. I rejoined in 2020, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometime in 2020, because then I had, you know, had a bit of money set aside. And I was like, okay, I believe the concept. You know, the Korean community focuses a lot on condos. Maybe even by extension, Korean and Iranian and perhaps Chinese as well, they focus a lot on condos. And that's great. Condos in Toronto, great. Have fun. But I really liked Rockstar Real Estate because the focus was always on cash flowing properties, right? And always about, you know, with a condo, you don't have a lot of control. Right? Like, what can you do? Pay down the mortgage and hope to God no one gets sued and slips on the, you know, the asphalt downstairs and the maintenance fees go up or something, right? Like what are you going to do, right? So with the model here, at least the model the way it was at the time, I think there's been some little bit of condo action here, but for the most part, it's been single family home rentals. And I like the rent-to-own concept, although I've never done it. It's just option trading, right? It's so cool, right? You just collect a big chunk of change and then, you know, have some hope that it's going to sell.
yeah. Your profits are locked in from...
Yeah, your profits are locked in and the guy who's there on site is motivated to take care of the property.
Mm-hmm. It's self-managed,
yeah. So that was... I don't know if I would do rent to own now. I don't know. Well, something to try at some point, right?
With the way the market's gone, it's definitely become less popular here with Rockstar Inner Circle members, just because people were starting to find they were leaving money on the table just with the amount of appreciation that homes were getting. But it's still a viable strategy. I mean, look what happened. The market's corrected. So somebody that had locked in a rent to own for a buyout during 2023, 2024, like they could actually be way ahead.
So one of our members who purchased a rent to own property in 2018, sold it to their tenant in 21 for whatever the agreed amount was. And that tenant in a year later sold it for another $200,000 above what he bought it for.
Yeah.
When the market was going up straight during free money time.
Yeah.
And so it was a win-win for the tenant buyer.
Yeah, I mean.
And so it balances out both.
For a certain period of time, it was very profitable for both profitably to be the tenant buyer.
Yeah. So they made themselves a good profit. But at the same time, so do the investors. Because, you know, if somebody tells you, hey, you're going to make $150,000 in 3 years, are you good with that? Most people are, right?
Yeah. That's yeah, it's definitely ROI. a good conservative approach.
Yeah.
It's nice to have people in your life where you're making the money too. Like, you know, I remember this guy asked me one time, he was like, doesn't it bother you that your agent's making money off of you? Why don't you go get your real estate license? Like, yeah, but I can't do everything. Like, I think I already do a lot. Thank you very much. Right. So it's like, why, what's wrong with surrounding yourself with other people who are making money from you? You know, as long as they're not doing it at your expense.
Well, to do what you're doing, you have a team built around you.
That's right.
So yeah. If you've got your Lego business, you've got your dating apps, you've got your insurance. Now you've got your real estate team. You've got us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how you get ahead, and that's how you balance your juggle all those balls, as you were saying, right?
And also, like, you know, like when you're looking at, when you get to know people and you can kind of learn sort of what they need, like with the Legos, for example, I have family's kids that sort the Legos for me, and I pay them, right, by the pound, right? I don't have time to sort the Legos. And so, you know, there's a way to sell them where you don't spend all your time sorting through orders. But then the question is, how do you get them from that box to individually? And when you're buying like 10 or 15 of the same box, it takes a while of sorting. So what I found out is there's this great tagline you can say to people: if you're looking to get rich quick, this is not for you. But if you're looking for something to do...
Well, there really isn't.
So you have an illegal child labor force sorting your Lego for you.
You know, honestly, most of the time the parents end up doing most of the work. it's like a table like this, and perhaps bigger, right? You need the space, right? Yeah. You take the Legos, I give them to them in a big bag, and they just put it out here, and then I give them a whole bunch of empty Ziploc bags, and then they start sorting through it. And I've had clients where they're like, oh, you know, this is great. It brings the family together. Right. Like we had grandma over last weekend, and, you know, like it was raining. And so we spent the whole time sorting Lego, and it's so mindless that people chat, and then it gets them coming back to me. And they're always like, I have this guy. He's like, oh, I need more Lego. You know, we're ready to return the pounds of Lego that we did before. And now we don't want to just return it. We want to return it and pick up more. So last week I messaged him and I said, okay, well, I mean, you know, I have 12 pounds. And no, I said, I have six. And he said, that's not enough. Can I wait for
more? I didn't realize there was such a community. Like, I knew that Lego was a big deal and a big hobby for people. And I know there's the Lego store and people go crazy, but just the whole economy around it.
Yeah.
I guess these niches never fail to surprise me, like how much money and people are involved in them.
Yeah, I think the thing to be really aware of is that people who've really thrown themselves into these niches 10 or 15 years ago, now they're like bona fide experts. You know, I can tell you all I want about my Lego business. You're never going to copy it, because by the time you get to where I am, I'll be 20 more steps ahead. It's like this. And it was the same in the dating too. Like, we could talk and talk and talk, and sometimes we felt like we told people too much stuff, but you know what? They're all out of business anyway. Who cares? It's just the mindset that gets you, right? The mindset that gets you to where you are now after doing something for so long is probably where all the magic is. And this is something that I like about, right, student rentals, right? With Rockstar Real Estate, is you can actually build a system around it. So, I mean, I have my one student rental, but, you know, we'll grow it into more, right? But it's like the idea is you can kind of make them all uniform and then build a process and that kind of thing, and then just keep doing it, right? So...
Yeah, once you have that system locked in, especially with student rentals, like, I'm such a fan of them too.
Yeah.
That it's just easy to repeat, you know, the exact types of homes, the income they're going to generate, how to fill it with students, how to manage the students. And then once you have a few of them too, like, things line up every year. Like, you're filling the properties at the same time, you're sending the same messages at the same time. Like, I just blasted out a message to all my students leaving at the end of this month, April, for May 1st, for the new tenants. Hey, you know, it's been great. Thank you for your time. Do you mind just please keeping getting the place as clean as it was when you first moved in? And then I copy all the parents on that, because I have all the parents' emails from when I do the parental guarantee document, when I sign the lease.
Yeah.
So now I've wrapped in the parents, and the parents tell their kids, hey, make sure you clean the damn property. And then I'm not just asking the kids anymore. I'm like looping their parents in, and
yep.
I don't know, there's a bit more accountability and stuff, but I'm just, over time, as I've been involved with these student rentals, noticing more and more of these systems and how to kind of automate it a little bit. It's still manual.
Like, many emails. Many people shy away from student rentals because it's too much work, or, you know, you felt all the negatives, right?
Yeah.
But it's just being involved, like, you're on top of it. That's the key. And student rentals are great as long as they're managed properly. Not because the property manager is managing it. You have to be involved as well, right? Not an absentee landlord. I know you're pretty active with your student rental. You're, you know,
more and more,
right? Yeah. So that's the way to go, and that's how you make money, right? It's creating that respect with the tenants, with the students, right?
Yeah. And they can be hell, to be fair, like if you don't manage them properly.
Sure. Yeah.
Like they can be the worst investment to deal with when you're filling individual bedrooms and stuff. Like,
yeah. Kids are, tenants, student rentals are great. The only thing I've always have an issue with is garbage recycling. And with that, yeah. You know, what I've done recently is I've started posting on the fridge, like a calendar. That's, you know, room one, room two, room three. That's their responsibility. Keeping them accountable by like putting a little $25 fine on it if somebody doesn't do the garbage, and that's their turn, and then they all get accountable. Hey, he didn't do the garbage. He owes us $25 in the pot, right? Kind of make it fun also as well. Like just everybody's accountable.
So you'll tell them there's a fine if you don't take up the
yeah,
garbage.
Yeah, we put it on the fridge magnet. Yeah.
And have you actually charged someone the fine?
No. But just making it fun, like making them accountable.
Right? How do you know if the garbage isn't being done? Just students are
by keeping students accountable.
To the other
room
students.
Room three will say, room two didn't do it. It was their turn. And they'll let me know, right? Right? Because they'll say, I don't want to be responsible for it. He didn't do the garbage last week. Or let's get the $25 and, you know, never really have had to. It's been managed.
I like that.
But it's just creating that little incentive, right? For everybody to be part of the garbage thing. Because garbage is the only issue that students are great. They study, they do whatever they do. But what kid at 18 years old, 19 years of age wants to take the garbage at even their parents' home, right?
Yeah. I've had the same issue. What I did is my place is obviously St. Catharines Thorold, as you know. So it's all the Niagara waste schedule. So I put on I have my rules for the house. I print them out, laminate them, put them on the fridge. It's like 5 pages laminated, stuck on the fridge. And one of the things is just about the garbage and recycling and what the schedule is. And then I have a QR code that they can use to download the Niagara garbage app.
Fine. Yeah, great.
And I just say, look, scan the QR code, download the app, and it'll tell you when garbage day is, recycling day, compost, all that stuff. Hmm. What the rules are. But it's still a struggle with some of them, right? Because they just pile it all up in the garage or the shed.
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, you got to take this stuff out. So some of them, I'll buy them extra garbage tags. Yeah. But then you kind of train them that you're going to buy them these tags.
Yeah.
So I haven't figured out a solution for that because I just don't want the garbage. So I'm like, here's some more tags. Go to a convenience store, buy your own tags. Yeah. But they don't, at least one group I have doesn't seem to do that.
Yeah, maybe put them on a...
I got to start finding them.
Buying them,
right? Yeah, I got to start.
Put in the pot for them, right? So it goes in the pot.
I'm sure we have a police uniform in the back office from one of those dating sites.
That we give you. Oh, man.
This guy's living his life in his terms already.
Yeah, you really are. It's so why real estate? Why have you branched out into real estate now? What, is it a retirement plan for you? Is it just another business model?
No, it's really just it's just the portion of my money that I want to grow sort of somewhat indexed, at least with inflation. But real estate also gives you options, right? Like you could have owned nothing. You know, if you own nothing, you could walk in a bank and, or let's put it this way. You could walk into a bank that you have a mortgage with and you could ask for a bank draft for $250,000 and they're not gonna ask you a question. Like, I've done it. But other banks, they might be like, what's this money for? You know, nitpicking shit like that, right? So I find that real estate kind of gives me options to kind of like flow money a little bit, you know, more with ease.
Why do you say that you can ask for a bank draft for $250,000 as a refinance or just to pull out of your bank? And
just to pull out of your bank, to do whatever the hell you want. Obviously, the bank draft is
$250,000. I find that hard to believe, man. These guys want to know what like $10,000 is for.
Yeah, they're pretty annoying, actually. Now, you can't even take more than $1,200 out of the ATM. Can you imagine?
Is that's a new law?
Cash.
Can't take out more than what?
$1,200. $1,200. It's like...
That's a new rule across all banks?
I don't know. It's like that at TD.
Interesting.
Yeah.
TD, I find especially like the tellers are giving me like stock advice. They're like asking what I'm doing. Yeah. One TD teller told me to put it all in Nintendo when Nintendo was pumping. Really? We're just talking. Yeah, I'm like, dude, can I just like get my money, get my access, like whatever the hell I'm there for it. Like, let's leave the financial advice, you know, or they're going to put you with their financial advisor and tell you to buy their top three mutual funds.
Should have put it in Lego.
Be a better investment. Yeah.
Every time you go to teller, they're always upselling you. Hey, do you have time to meet our advisor in the back? No. That's okay. I'm going to use my money for real estate.
But that's the way the system works, right? I mean, the teller sends you over there and they get some kind of credit or bonus. They don't necessarily get a commission, but they probably get some kind of quota. I know with TD, they have to get some kind of quota. When I worked at RBC, I used to always, you know, I was working for the insurance side of it, but at the bank, they loved me. They were just like, oh my God, we're like family. And then I could ask them all the questions, like, you know, you're paid a base. Yes. You get a commission. Yes. Is your base like, what, like 20, 30,000 like that? Yeah, somewhere around there. Okay. So probably lower. Okay. You know, kind of like, you know, brainstorm it out. And I'm pretty good at figuring out how people make money. Like, this is one of my skills, right? You don't have to tell me too much for me to figure out where the money goes and how it works. And this is like, you know, and real estate, honestly, like, you know, back to your question, right? I don't really see real estate as a huge moneymaker. I just see it as, like insurance, another option, right? The real money in anything is in the business and the guy who runs the business and who, you know, who structures it properly in order to put the profit at the end of the day and have something left over for himself. And, you know, and keeping your cards close to yourself, I guess. That's a little lesson of the years.
So everything else you've done, crypto? Bitcoin?
No, crypto, no Bitcoin. Yeah, I bought a little bit, but that was it. Yeah. It's not really my thing.
Buy Solana?
Sorry?
Did you buy Solana?
Did he? I thought you said Selena. I was like, who's that? Should I meet her?
You can find her on one of your sites.
Probably.
So Nadim came up to, we don't have to talk about crypto too much, but Nadim came up to us like a couple months ago me and Nigel.
Six months ago.
And he goes, what do you guys know about Solana? And I'm like, honestly, man, nothing. Like, we're Bitcoiners. Like, we stick to Bitcoin. We think Solana is a shitcoin. We don't know anything about it, but shitcoin. And Nadim's like, I don't know, this like 19-year-old guy I know told me it's about to pump. We're like, all right, if you want to listen to the 19-year-old. And so we talked Nadim out of it, basically. It wasn't just us. I think it was Tom, too, or whatever. Mm. And so he doesn't buy it. And then it goes on to...
shoots like from $20 to like $100, like in like 4 months.
To the moon. You're going to put what, $1,000 in?
Something like that. Yeah.
$5,000? $1,000? A couple, I don't know, a couple grand or whatever. And Nadim's just been like... pissed about it for the last 6 months. I'm like, honestly, you probably shouldn't have listened to me about that.
Yeah. I like creating my own economies. I don't really like buying things that don't have optionality. Mm-hmm. You know, like for instance, I recently moved into a new condo and I need to set up some storage within the condo in order to accommodate my, you know, Legos. And so, obviously I'm only doing adjustments to the condo that are also going to increase the retail value of the condo in a year's time, 2 years time, should I decide to sell it. And if not, then whatever. And I'm also thinking about if I want to rent it out, how will this, okay, this new storage system, it'll double down as a pantry. Okay, great. So that'll double down for this. So I like every sort of decision that I make moving forward all the time is just, it's about optionality. And even like the people sorting the Lego for me, they're also insurance clients, right? Like that kind of thing. Like it's just like I'm always, and of course I'm a big fan of like young kids learning financial planning and tactics and like strategies, that kind of stuff. Myself, like when I was six, I started a business selling bookmarks. And then when I was eight, I was selling puppets. And then when I was 12, I was baking bread. And my dad was a chiropractor and I was selling the bread in the office. And so like these businesses over the years, they kind of trained me to always be thinking about not the second or third income stream, but like the seventh or eighth income stream. And yeah, like that and along with the, you know, the fact of just kind of making your business kind of interlock and just really doing what you like doing. Yeah, I don't have anything to say about Bitcoin because it's like, I can't control it. Mm-hmm. I'd much rather own a casino that makes a little bit of money every year than own Bitcoin that's hopefully going to skyrocket. Because then even if it skyrockets, I don't learn anything. Like how did it skyrocket? Maybe I'll run a PR team that promotes Bitcoins, shitcoins, and turn them into the next Bitcoin. And that'll be a moneymaker, like shipping, right? Mm. The shipping company is paying you every day to hold the oil. Who cares what the oil's worth? The shipping companies always get paid. Right? Like that. That's how I see it anyway.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. You like having control over the income, the expenses, the optionality, the exit strategy.
Yeah.
And yeah, with Bitcoin, you don't have that. Obviously you buy it, you hold it, you hope that it continues to inflate over time in fiat price.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's nothing wrong with putting a little allocation into it.
Yeah.
And there was that study that somebody had done, right? Where they looked at over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, you know, had Bitcoin or whatever, they kind of charted some stuff out. I mean, I guess Bitcoin's been around for long enough that we can say 10 years, right? And they were like just 5%, you know, reallocated or readjusted every couple of years, the portfolios always did much better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously there's something there. And maybe, you know, I used to have a rule where I acted on every single tip I got, just $500. Who cares? $500, you know, pair of shoes.
Huh. How did that turn out for you? That's really interesting.
Very well, actually. Very well.
Has it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So every little stock tip, every business tip.
Yeah.
Every crypto tip.
No. Not crypto, no business tip. Just stock tips.
So I'm like, hey, I got this thing. You'll just throw 500 at it.
Yeah, basically.
And it's panned out for you.
Yeah.
All right, have you held on to these things or just kind of were like, whoa, that went up a lot and I'm selling?
No, I sold most of it recently just to pay off some debt.
Yeah. I kind of like that.
Yeah. No, it's like you learn a little bit more. I have this friend who's so much more technical on the stocks than I am. And he'll be like, hey, you know, the line of the 32-day average or whatever the hell it is dipping, so it's going to go up or whatever. It's going up, so it's going to go up. The stock hasn't adjusted. And he used to always be like, yeah, sure, whatever. And he's he gets kicks out of telling me he made money, you know, especially when I didn't do it. And so at one point, I just decided, that's it. I'm just not even going to question it. I'm just going to do it. And with AMD in particular, you know, like I didn't make a lot, but maybe like an extra $9,000 or $10,000 over the course of a couple of years just by doing the trades he said he was doing without even looking into it. Because I'm not betting on the stock. I'm betting on him, basically.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you get to appease that little FOMO and
you do.
And just, you know, it's not going to break the bank at the same time. I kind of like that. I might try that. Hmm. Cool. So then maybe why did you pick student rentals? Why was that the go-to strategy? You like the single family homes. You like the cash flow from day one. You like that it maybe wasn't as speculative. You have more control over it versus a condo.
I didn't pick the student rentals. I was going to do rent to own.
I think, yeah, that's what we're on our tour that when he joined, we were doing the tour of properties, you know, looking at multi-unit, student rentals, rent to owns. Rent to own was kind of where he was leaning towards. And then we found the student rental that kind of was newer. It had, you know, potential to give him some good cash flow at that time. And I think the rates were kind of going up at that time. Or no, they were whatever it was. Yeah. Cash flow was good. And that's what kind of, he's all about cash, right? So
not just that, though. Like, I mean, like we looked at the place. It had just recently been built, right? And then Nadim was like, and you know, like I'll fill it up with tenants for you for free if you take it. Like, what?
You made him an offer he can't refuse, eh?
Made an offer, couldn't refuse. And I was just like, oh, that's it.
You're free, but.
Not, maybe not for free. I don't remember what it was, but it was like, and then, you know, we were walking around it and I was like, well, the price is whatever it is, right? And I was thinking bidding wars. And I was thinking, oh God, you know, I don't want to. You know, I don't want.
I remember. Yes, that's the time when everything you looked at was like 100,000 over, and this is kind of an exclusive listing that you know we get through our channels.
This was one of your relationships with the builders you have.
Yeah, so it's Niagara is a exclusive, and kind of just say, then there's no bidding. This is the price, and kind of I think that's maybe what attracted to him because he knew what he was paying for.
Yeah, there's nothing more, you know, I don't know, annoying than it's like eBay bidding, you know. You're supposed to put the maximum price you're willing to pay, and that's it. But eBay is proxy bidding. So even though the highest bidder just bid $5 and you put 10, you're not going to pay 10, you're going to pay 6. But with house bidding, it's not like that, right? If the maximum price I'm going to pay is 10, that's what I'm going to pay is 10, right? So I don't like that, right? Obviously.
Yeah. It can get emotional too because you get caught up in that bidding and the FOMO because when there's multiple offers like that and homes are going 100 grand over asking, like real estate's pumping. And so you have massive FOMO to get into this thing.
But it's hard with what we do is we want to make the numbers work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets more personal with people with personal residential homes that they're buying for themselves.
Mm.
Yeah, you have to take the emotions out of it.
Yeah.
So this is a Brock University student rental?
Yep. It was probably and, like 2 streets over from yours.
Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking in my head. I wanted to ask you, you know, what street it's on because it's probably pretty close to.
Yeah, it's not far from yours. Yeah.
Yeah, and what are you getting per room?
What am I getting per room? $650, I think.
Yeah, cool. That's what I'm getting. Yep. The highest I've got. Actually, I got $700 and $675 on two of the bigger rooms within a property, but all the other ones are $650. But those guys pay a bit more just because it's like kind of premium. Yeah, premium real estate.
I've never had any problems with the rent. A couple of times, people shopping the property would be like, hey, can we get a discount if I move into the room with my girlfriend or something? But then it's like two people. And then it's like, you know, the fridge gets pretty full. Like we bought a second fridge, right? Like there's two huge fridges there. And I don't know. That was a really nice plug for the Koreans. I needed a second fridge. It was in the middle of COVID-ish stuff when like there was like, you couldn't buy a fridge on Best Buy site without any kind of like 3 or 4 month delay. I walked over to my friend's place, does acupuncture, and I was like, hey, do you know anyone who sells appliances? He's like, yeah, let's go. So off we go to this place near up in Thornhill, I guess. And was called HD something, HD Electronics or something. And this guy was just like, yeah, I got this fridge. And I was like, I'll pay like this and like this. And he's like, yeah, where's my friend referral discount and that kind of thing. And I said, what's it cost to deliver it? He's like, $200. I said, could you deliver it to Thorold? He's like, yeah, but I'm sorry, sir. You know, I can only deliver it in 3 days. So I was like,
oh, wow,
this is great. And so within like 3 or 4 days, there was another fridge there. And it's like a refurbished Samsung or something. It still works. So it works great.
Yeah.
Basically new.
Yeah, you need the second fridge. Even if it's just 5 students, I find the second fridge is a huge bonus for them. Like, and they go crazy over it.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than having mini fridges. And if you don't provide them with a second fridge, if you need it for that property, and mini fridges, that's kind of... your utility bills are going higher.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So for our 2 7-bedroom places, we do 2 fridges and 1 chest freezer.
Okay.
Mm. And that's, and they...
Chest freezer.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. A little chest freezer addition. And they go through a lot of frozen food too, students, right?
Yeah.
And that seems good. But then for our 5-bedroom place, we do 2 fridges. And that's more than enough for 5 people. But I don't know about you, Nadeem. To that point, I'm seeing more and more people that want to split a room. And couples, for sure. Yeah. That want to split a room, but then also international students. They're like, look, it's just too expensive. We're splitting a room. And then I'm filling a place for an investor right now. Mm-hmm. And it's a student place, Brock on Jacobson. So great spot. And then there's students living there now as I'm doing the showings for May 1st. And there's 2 international students splitting a bedroom already, like 2 mattresses on the floor. So it's like they're just trying to save money. I feel bad for these kids. Like they're getting kind of screwed over when they come here.
The last year or two, we've seen the influx of international students, right? Yeah. I think it's a record high. And a lot of them, unfortunately, don't have the ability to maintain and pay for 1 room. So they're sharing. Yeah, lots of couples.
Yeah, it's happening more and more.
More and more.
You just see like it's just happening everywhere in society. Like people are getting less for their money.
Right.
So you sacrifice that quality to save that money.
But again, it's not the same price because again, you're using utilities, you know, wearing
care
of the property. So it's never that price. So
that's the thing.
Yeah, you have to charge a premium on it.
Yeah.
Even if you're not going to charge the amount for 2 bedrooms, you got to charge. Yeah.
Usually it's, it's a tough call. You feel bad to say no, but you have to also do what's best for you because having 2 people in 1 room is not always the creating more people in 1 house.
Yeah.
But it's not intended to be like 7-8 people when it's really meant for 5 or 6, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's the kind of tough part about real estate is all the turning down of tenants and stuff because it's like, it's people's lives and you get emotionally involved and you feel bad. And you just like really see what's happening on the streets with like the housing crisis. You're like, people are getting desperate out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's the tough part.
Yeah.
Not just that, just also like the guy at that the condo that we looked at there recently, you know, like there's no locker, there's no extra storage.
Mm-hmm.
The place is like full of stuff, you know, and I think he was trying to fit an aquarium in there somehow, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was just like, it gets pretty packed, right?
Yeah.
Like, units aren't necessarily made for having so much in them. And you're totally right. Actually, even in the case of a student rental, what is it? It's not necessarily meant to have 5 individual people. I mean, you know, you convert the living room into a room and you convert, maybe there's no other common room into a room either. So it's like in the case of when I got, it was fairly new and built for that.
Purpose built.
So, I mean, even more so to your point, right? It's crazy.
Yeah. What I like about the student rental is another aspect that I hadn't really thought of before, but I'm selling one of my places right now just to reposition some funds. And I like how it kind of keeps me nimble, like my property's nimble. I don't have that long-term tenant in there.
Mm.
And so I know these guys are on a cycle of, you know, I could get them out if I want after the 12-month lease.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the long-term tenant, it's a huge deal and they can stay if they want and the students can stay too.
Yeah.
But it's like max eight, they're really going to stay is 3 years because then they're done their program.
Yeah.
But then with students too, you can just be like, hey, like I've decided to sell, like, you know, do you guys are going to need to find a new place for next year. And it's like, they're kind of okay with that. Like it's not the same long-term commitment with that long-term tenant, which really limits your options when you're selling the property. So I never thought about it from an exit point of view, but I like that it keeps me nimble that way too.
Because of I'm actually selling one student rental currently, and there's more ask people wanting to live in it personally than students. People buy, for investors buying, it's more people looking to buy and live in it.
How many bedrooms are in it?
It's got seven, but the two rooms could be put back to a family room and dining room. Mm-hmm. But that's the demand. People are like knocking on the door wanting to buy it personally.
Families.
So.
And that wouldn't happen in the past?
No. Just such a supply shortage, right?
Wow.
So.
Yeah, that's so.
So what we've decided is we're going to hold off till the students, I think their leases are up on April 30th, and we're going to sort of stage it and clean it up a little bit and sell it as a single family home.
Really?
Yeah, probably for maximum returns.
Yeah, seven bedroom
so
place.
So talking exit strategy. Well, the seven bedroom could be five, right? There's a family.
Yeah, it can always be converted back.
Family just, and dining room, which is going to be put back to where we used to be.
Yeah, it's just whether or not someone wants to go through the effort to do that.
Well, you get the maximum value, right? So it's worth it.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it always can be converted back.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a single family home at the end of the day. Might have had a few more extra bedrooms added, but you can always, it's usually the dining room that gets converted, living room stays, and then maybe, the basement gets chopped up into more bedrooms than it would typically be like an open space.
Yeah.
So it's easy to.
So that's the good strategy as an exit strategy for student rental.
Yeah.
Like this time right now, market is really hot for people looking to move in, live themselves, and that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Put it back single family.
Okay, what's next for Mr. Daniel Mascott?
After this, I'm going to go to the gym and then go back home and work.
Start three more businesses.
There's a lot to be said for having, your core businesses and saying no to other opportunities. Like for me, it's always just Lego has been since day one, right? Sure, there have been some slower months. COVID obviously made Legos great because everybody was at home and everyone just wanted, I had to really work out my pricing strategy, but because with Lego, you can kind of increase the price every like 6-8 months, a little bit, not a lot, but like a little bit. And so, if I had not maintained my pricing strategy and kind of kept an eye on things, especially in like May 2020, I would have sold all my inventory. And then I would be stuck buying, like it wouldn't be a bad thing necessarily, but Lego, a lot of business comes in when someone goes, oh, if I buy this from this guy and this from that guy, I'm going to pay twice as much shipping. Okay, I'll pay a little bit more from this guy, but I'll save on the shipping. And I always put my shipping prices lower, especially to kind of accommodate that because my prices are higher. So that sort of pricing strategy, it's definitely like a long-term thing. You just kind of tweak it along, play along with it. High inventory value, low transaction amount, but you kind of have like a reaction time that you can play around with. Insurance is more of the hustle, right? And then the dating, well, I don't know. Who knows where that'll go? I mean, the dating market has changed a lot in the last couple of years. People are tired. Like people are, especially like on the vanilla dating apps, as we call them, right? Like the Bumbles and the Tinders. Everybody knows everyone's just on there to smash. That's it. Right. So it's not really a real dating site. You have some like somewhat real connections that can happen on like eHarmony or Match or those kind of things, those kind of sites. And they are fine. But people are generally speaking kind of fed up of going through so many people online and then people flaking and canceling. And this happens a lot. So I'm not too sure where that's going to go, but I'm banking more on Legos and insurance.
Mm. Than the online dating.
Yeah.
From what I've heard about people doing it, they're like just so, they are sick and tired of it. They're like, it sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, they are actually.
But I think like over half of people now meet on dating apps.
Yeah. Seems so.
And I've found that with like my friend group, like a bunch of them have met on apps. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of professional groups that you can join as well. Like a few years ago, I joined the Rotary Club of Toronto. This is like a group of people that I'm still probably in the younger than average age group of the club, but great people, and they attract great people. Mm-hmm. And it's everyone part of the club. The focus is on fixing, helping, not fixing, because we'll probably never fix it, but helping address problems in the city of homelessness, mental health, and food insecurity. So everybody's coming together with this common goal, and nobody's talking about, hey, buy my book or buy my insurance product. And no one's talking about that. You're making friends. Maybe that comes later, but you're making friends with that common goal. Like I think next weekend we have this thing called Clean Up the Don, where a bunch of clubs get together and we clean up the valley that's along the Don something. I don't even know where it is, to be honest.
Don River?
I feel like I live, what?
The Don River?
Perhaps. It must be, yeah. Let's say yes. So some part of Toronto for sure. And you know, this is what we do. We just get together and, you know, clean up this thing. A couple of weeks ago, we had our annual poker night. It's like a charity poker night where you buy in, it goes to charity. It's like our biggest fundraiser of the year. And this is a lot of fun, right? And it's like you're volunteering or you're participating or you're planning or you're coordinating volunteers. You're doing fun stuff with other people. This is the kind of stuff that's kind of lacking. I think, I'm pretty sure, like you're not going to get that from doing this, mm-hmm. swiping, right? Like mm-hmm. you're going to get it from getting off your ass and going to meet people. And you got to do it, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Cool, man. Well, I'm all out of questions. You're an interesting guy. Nadim, do you have any questions?
No, I think we covered a lot of it.
Thanks for coming in, man, and just sharing. It's cool how you've set up your life and all these different income streams, and you can tell that you are passionate about these different things. So it's kind of cool to see. And I'm just excited to see how it keeps unfolding, especially the real estate stuff now too, like, and how you're going to marry all that stuff. Married it all together, man.
Yeah. We'll see. One day at a time.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it. And do you want to share anything or where people can find you, or do you have anything?
Yeah, I have an Instagram account. FSDM Planning, Financial Services Daniel Mascot.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Pleasure.
So thank you to Daniel Mascot for coming in and sharing his journey of multiple different businesses and how he was able to create his life on his own terms and continue to do so. It was really interesting hearing about all that. And thank you to Nadim Ahmed, his Rockstar Inner Circle investing coach as well, for coming on. And it's always great having a coach here to balance real estate stuff off of as well. So thank you to Nadim and Daniel. If you want to check out Daniel's Instagram, we put the link in the show notes for you to access it easily so you can follow along his journey more. And if you're interested in working with your own rockstar real estate investing coach like Daniel does with Nadim, and having that support system and person to lean on as you build your portfolio for whatever your real estate investing goals are, to reach whatever your life on your terms means to you, then reach out. Ask us any question you want, or we can just be your next steps, help you get set up with an experienced investor like Nadim to guide you along your own real estate journey. Go to rockstarinnercircle.com, call us, email us, text us, whatever you want to do. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you on the next show.